Hello, folks. Welcome back to the second hour of The Light of Day with your host, Sheldon Day, coming to you live on Orion. Saturday night, November 20th, 2010. This is show number 35 now on Orion. Well, I appreciate Jimmy there at the network playing that MP3 soundbite. Unfortunately, we weren't able to finish it, but it was pretty close to the end. I may eventually, I'll be posting that on my website, so you can look for it there soon. I'm going to play this John Moore thing over one more time, and then we're going to get into some news for the remainder of the hour. I thought that this John Moore thing I had made today was so good that I need to play it again. Sometimes we have listeners joining us later in the show, so in case you folks, some of you folks might have missed it, we're going to play this John Moore soundbite now, so please enjoy.
This topic, as far as U.S. government is concerned, is one of the most highly classified matters that the government deals with. We're not sure about the date, but it's going to happen. When it does, there's going to be abrupt climate change. There's going to be 200-mile-an-hour winds. There's going to be massive tidal winds. It's coming. It's going to hit us. It's going to hit us hard. And it's going to be 200-mile-an-hour winds. And there's going to be massive tidal waves and earthquakes. The cause is the 10th planet. Now, what NASA is calling the 10th planet is not the 10th planet we're concerned about.
Okay, folks, I wasn't synchronized very well there. I'm trying to listen to the soundbite on my own website stream here while that's playing, and then I was answering a message here with Jimmy. But anyway, those things happen. We'll be coming into the break again. You're listening to the Light of Day here on Orion. We're live Saturday night, November 20th, 2010. I hope you folks enjoyed that soundbite by John Moore. I thought it was pretty outstanding myself. That's why I wanted to play it again. When we come back from the break, we'll be reading some stuff off Cheryl Nelson's website and be talking about comets that have been hitting the sun. An upcoming episode of Coast to Coast AM. An email from Tonda about a planet from another galaxy spotted. And, of course, the first thing I'll be talking about when we come out of the break is the death of astronomer Dr. Brian Marsden. It's amazing how nobody seems interested in this, but I was. Folks, welcome back to the Light of Day with your host Sheldon Day and Orion. We're live Saturday night, November 20th, 2010. Unfortunately, I wasn't synchronized very well there when I was playing that John Moore replay. I actually left my volume slider on the mixer board for my microphone, and I was listening to that through my website stream. The speakers here on top of my computer. I was listening to what I was inputting into the network, so you might have heard, like, it sounded like John Moore playing in the background while John Moore was talking. So I'm just going to have to edit that out of my archive because I don't like that. Anyway, we better get into the news here because that break will be coming up before we know it. We had this astronomer, Brian Marsden, that died yesterday, if memory serves me correct. The days go fast. It's like 2 days is the equivalent of a 7-day period now. It's just amazing how fast the time is going. Anyway, we're going to give a little background on the deaths of other astronomers here. It's entitled Murdered for Exposing Nibiru? That way you have a little background here on what's going on. Robert S. Harrington, at the time head of the Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C., was head of NASA's Planet X internal study and was on his final trip to New Zealand to photograph Planet X. He died suddenly of the same rapid onset type of cancer that Chuck Schrammick died from. And you can go to Marshall Masters' website for an article on that in more detail. Dr. Robert Harrington, the chief astronomer of the U.S. Naval Observatory, died before he could publicize the fact that Planet X is approaching our solar system. Many feel his death was part of a cover-up, one in which government agencies quickly moved to conceal the most earth-shaking discovery in history. If so, the search for truth begins in New Zealand. In 1991, Dr. Harrington, the chief astronomer of the U.S. Naval Observatory, took a puny 8-inch telescope to Black Birch, New Zealand, one of the few viewing points on Earth optimal for sighting Planet X, which he definitely calculated to be approaching from below the ecliptic at an angle of 40 degrees. Now, you folks might want to go to my Archives Miscellaneous subpage. I posted a Marshall Masters soundbite that I sent out to my email list here a few days ago. It has background music embedded in it, and it Marshall gets into detail about how the disinformation crew is distracting folks by stampeding them out to the sun by making the masses think that Planet X is near the sun at this time. And you know, I believe Marshall Masters is with the elites. But I do agree with him on this, that the Planet X is not by the sun like a lot of people are thinking it is. Anyway, back to the article. By analyzing time-lapse photographs using the blink comparison technique originated by famed Pluto discoverer Clyde Tombaugh, Dr. Harrington proved that Planet X was indeed inbound into our solar system. And if you folks recall, I played those Professor Jim McCanny sound bites where he mentioned that the Wormwood installation down in Australia was monitoring a mini solar system coming into ours about 6 years ago. Dr. Harrington sent back reports of this ominous discovery but died of what was reported to be esophageal cancer before he could pack up his telescope and come home to hold what would have been a highly publicized press conference. Now, Chuck Schrammick, now this is a guest that's been on the Art Bell Show back in the mid-90s. He was a Houston, Texas news host and who took photos of Nibiru, companion of Hale Bopp, and appeared on the old Art Bell Show. He died of the same sudden onset cancer that took out Dr. Harrington. Hale Bopp, like Nibiru, follows an elliptical orbit. Now here's a separate guy, Gene Shoemaker. He was a NASA planetary geologist while studying ancient asteroid impacts in Australia. He was a prolific discoverer of comets. Shoemaker had access to the Southern Hemisphere data, as did Harrington. He could see the vast comet Hale-Bopp and knew, as did NASA at that time, of the original discovery of Hale-Bopp, which must have been in the same time that Harrington was viewing Planet X, and that Hale-Bopp at that time was on a near-direct collision course with Earth. It later fell behind schedule due to the tail drag and missed us by nearly 3 months. And I don't know if you folks know this, but the comet Hale-Bopp affected Earth weather for a period of like 6 or 7 years while it was in our solar system. So comets aren't just little dirty, icy snowballs. They're actually an electrical phenomena. They discharge the solar capacitor as they swing through our solar system. That's another well-kept secret the powers to be don't want the masses to know about. That's just my side note there, folks. Spill the beans on all of this. Like Harrington, Gene Shoemaker was well known and would have carried many scientists with him. The story of his death is the most ridiculous lie you would ever hear. There was no autopsy and there is no information available other than there was a Jeep crash and he died on the way to the hospital. His ashes were blasted in outer space out of a NASA satellite as a tribute. Well, isn't that sweet? Now, the Heaven's Gate cult, if you folks recall this, this was a incident that happened in Southern California back in the mid-90s. This was not a cult, folks, but was a group of 39 or more very highly talented programmers who were not suicidal. They were building the most sophisticated firewall and encryption software on the planet when their webpage mentioned the comet Hale-Bopp and all of a sudden became very popular as they were about to leave society. They were called to a meeting in the Mole. We think that programmer Mole is quite active on the current Planet X government disinformation website and related work on the web. Yes, these are some really nice folks working for your government. The Mole informed the execution squad, and one by one as the programmers entered the house, they were murdered. There was never an autopsy performed. The government immediately pulled down and changed their website and had a huge front page disinformation campaign in place all over the country. Now, I'd like to talk about the death of Brian Marsden here. Quick factoids from a few separate web pages on this Dr. Brian Marsden guy that died yesterday. This astronomer sort of has similar attributes to Thomas Van Flandren after studying it, folks. And if you recall, Tom Van Flandren was a close associate of Robert Harrington, and Flandren died the early part of last year. Dr. Brian Marsden passed away yesterday at the age of 73 following a prolonged illness. He was a supervisory astronomer at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and director emeritus of the Minor Planet Center. Brian G. Marsden, who was director of the International Astronomical Union's Minor Planet Center, joined it in 1978, was the official record keeper for most of the astronomical discoveries in the solar system in recent decades. Well, actually, he died 2 days ago, folks. According to an obituary bulletin from the Minor Planet Center, he was 73. We'll be back. You're listening to Live Dan Orion. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Live Dan Orion. This is your host, Sheldon Day. We're live Saturday night, November 20th, 2010. Back to the article about the passing of Dr. Brian Marsden. For folks that just may be tuning in, this has to do with the astronomer that just passed away 2 days ago, and I had given a background on the deaths of some other astronomers, including Thomas Van Flandren and Gene Shoemaker and Robert Harrington and Chuck Schrammick. You know, at a time when Planet X could be getting extremely close to piercing the southern the ecliptic table as it comes up from the south, they may have to start doing away with certain people with high credentials so the elites can successfully get their last-minute preparations underway without worrying about what the masses are going to learn about the incoming passage of this brown dwarf star, which is at least 1,000 Earth masses. That's how massive of an object this is. Well, back to what I was reading on Brian Marsden. The Minor Planet Center, housed since Marsden took it over in 1978 at the Smithsonian Astronomical Observatory in Cambridge, serves as a clearinghouse of data collected by observers around the world, amateur and professional alike. The center catalogs the data and computes orbits for objects such as near-Earth asteroids, main belt asteroids, comets, and distant bodies in a region near the orbit of Pluto known as the Kuiper Belt. It also notifies astronomers of which newfound objects are in need of follow-up observations and confirmation. So if you folks just think about that, there may have been a reason why they would have had to eliminate this guy who was the record keeper of this institution. Like I said, the Minor Planet Center, where he was the director of, is an official organization in charge of collecting observational data for asteroids and comets calculating their orbits and publishing this information via circulars. Brian was one of the most influential comet investigators of the 20th century. Now keep in mind, folks, there were two comets that actually slammed into the sun between the 14th and the 19th, and these are being referred to as the Kreutz family of sun grazer comets. A bright comet just discovered on November 17th by Polish comet hunter Michael Kuziak, this is the second one, folks, that hit the sun, is about to disappear forever. The problem is it is diving toward the sun. On November 14th, another comet followed the same path and met the same fate. This would have been the first of the two. It's no coincidence. Both are fragments of a giant parent comet that broke apart about 2,000 years ago. Astronomers call them Kreutz sun grazers after the 19th century German researcher Heinrich Kreutz, who studied them in detail. According to some estimates, several Kreutz comets pass by the sun and disintegrate every day. Most are too small to see, but occasionally a large fragment or two attracts attention. And, you know, I don't have the dot connector right here in front of me, folks, but this Mr. Marsden guy had something to do with this, I believe, the discovery of this Kreutz family of sun grazer comets. I hope I'm making sense to you folks out there, because I can see in my mind what's going on here. You just have to give it some deep thought. Now, Dr. Marsden specialized in celestial mechanics and astrometry, collecting data on the positions of asteroids and comets and computing their orbits, often from minimal observational information. Such calculations are critical for tracking potentially Earth-threatening objects. Did you hear that, folks? Tracking potentially Earth-threatening objects. He was the director of the Minor Planet Center from 1978 up until 2006. Dr. Marsden also played a key role in the demotion of Pluto to dwarf planet status. He will be remembered as contributing much to celestial mechanics and the dynamics and orbits of minor bodies of the solar system. Among the various awards he received from the U.S. and the U.K. and a handful of other European countries, the ones he particularly appreciated were the 1989 Van Beesbroek Award, then presented by the University of Arizona for service to astronomy. And the cause of this guy's death, folks, it was pretty hard for me to find, but I came across it on slackerastronomy.org. It claims that he died after contracting pneumonia on top of the leukemia he had been fighting for the past year. So who knows what the truth really is. I mean, they can induce cancer. That's that's a fact. They can induce cancer even remotely from a distance to people they want to eliminate. Oh, let's see. We're going to go to Cheryl Nelson's website here. I don't know if you folks ever check her website out, earthchanges.ning.com. She's got a bill on here that was introduced to the Congress that allows the government to shut down whistleblower websites, U.S. Senate Bill 3804. Listen to this, folks. Just the other day, Obama urged other countries to stop censoring the Internet. But now the U.S. Congress is trying to censor the Internet here at home. A new bill being debated this week would have the Attorney General create an Internet blacklist of sites that U.S. Internet providers would be required to block. The first vote was scheduled 2 days ago, folks. This bill, giving the government the power to shut down websites that host materials that infringe copyright, is making its way quietly through the lame duck session of Congress, raising the ire of free speech groups and prompting a group of academics to lobby against the effort. The Combating Online Infringement and Counterfeits Act was introduced in Congress this fall by Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont. It would grant the federal government the power to block access to any web domain that is found to host copyrighted material without permission. Critics say the bill is both a giveaway to the movie and record recording industries and a step towards widespread and unaccountable censorship of the Internet. Opponents note that the powers given the government under the bill are very broad. Because the bill targets domain names and not specific materials, an entire website can be shut down. So, for example, if the U.S. determines that there are copyright-infringing materials on YouTube, it could theoretically block access to all of YouTube, whether or not particular material being accessed infringes copyright. So if you go to Cheryl Nelson's website, earthchanges.ning.com, you can check that out. You know, I've been saying on past shows that as Planet X gets closer, the astronomical community folks are going to be sharing images, and I believe that's part of the reason that they're really shutting down the Internet. But then again, there's something like at least 1,300 or 1,500 websites out there to talk about Planet X, and they may also need to get the Internet somewhat censored because of the folks that are keeping their mouths open about what's really going on here. Let's see, what else we got? Pandemic simulated reality show has audience participate in graphic survival scenarios. I sent that off to Dr. Carly today. That's right up her alley. By the way, folks, I archive Dr. Carly's shows on my website. If you go to my homepage and just click on the Dr. Carly archives there on the menu, you can, that'll take you over to her website, or to the, I'm sorry, to her archives page. I archive all her shows. I haven't gotten her show up yet from today. I've just been too busy, but it'll be up there by sometime tomorrow afternoon. Watery future for coastal cities. This was posted by Cheryl Nelson about 6 hours ago. That looks like a good one to read. Well, you're listening live, Dan Orion. This is your host, Sheldon Day. We're live Saturday night, November 20th. Watery future for coastal cities. This was posted 3 days ago. Bangkok, Thailand. Thinking of buying a condominium in one of the hospitable, thriving capitals of sunny Southeast Asia, you might check out their flood prevention plans beforehand. While the debate over global warming continues, Southeast Asia's coastal capitals have been facing the reality of extreme weather and its soggy companion water. 3 years ago, flooding in Jakarta inundated much of Indonesia's capital, killing 57 people, displacing 450,000 and causing an estimated $700 million in damage. Tropical storm Ketsana dumped record rainfall on Manila in September of last year. It submerged 80% of the metropolis, killed about 400 and displaced up to 300,000 people. Hello, folks. Welcome back to the last segment of the Live Day with your host, Sheldon Dan Orion. We're live Saturday night, November 20th, 2010. Back to the article, Watery Future for Coastal Cities. This is over in the Southeast Asia. Minister Mentor Lee Kuan Yew said, "When we get extraordinary rainfall like we had recently, no amount of engineering can prevent flooding." Now, folks, if even Singapore can't cope with abnormal weather, what hope for the rest of the region, especially in the context of potentially rising sea levels? But the recent disasters have provided ample incentive for the region's coastal cities to make preparations for a watery future with or without global warming. So, you know, here they are hinting to us in the mainstream news articles about what's coming, folks. It's not hard for me to see. I can connect the dots quite well. You know, historically, evidence has suggested that as Planet X comes in, there's massive inundations of flooding everywhere. This is one of the preeminent precursor signs that the imminent passage of Planet X is getting close, is massive flooding everywhere, like we've been seeing. I remember up in central Wisconsin 2 summers ago, the city I'm from, Fond du Lac, they had people going down the street in boats up there. Pretty incredible. Well, you folks might want to check out Coast to Coast this Wednesday night because there's going to be some guests on there talking about the Denver airport. I can't remember what the guy's name is, but you might want to check that out. Got an email I want to read here quick. We're getting pretty close to the end of the show. There's other stuff I'd like to read on Cheryl Nelson's website, but we just don't have the time. This pertains to NASA's Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer spacecraft, which recently located another brown dwarf star back on November 9th. I fired an email off to Gilbert Erickson, who's been on my show at least two times now, and he had a reply to this. He said, you know, I got to thinking, is this brown dwarf in that part of the sky where Planet X is coming in? And Gilbert replied by stating that, no, it's not. It's actually in the constellation Camelopardalis, if that's how you pronounce it, which is located high in the northern fall sky, surrounded by Perseus, Cassiopeia, Ursa Minor, Ursa Major, Cepheus, and Lynx. Anyway, NASA's WISE spacecraft located this brown star, which was pinpointed to be at right ascension 4 hours, 54 minutes, and 3 seconds, with a declination of plus 66 degrees, 20 minutes, and 34 seconds, which is pretty much in the opposite part of the sky from where Planet X is coming in. So no, NASA was not telling us that this was Planet X, but NASA did give some insightful information that tells us that what they're able to see with this spacecraft. The most interesting comment that NASA gives in this article is the temperature reference. This is one of the coolest brown dwarfs known, with a temperature of roughly 600 Kelvin, which would be 620 degrees Fahrenheit. That is some very interesting information, because it confirms the brown dwarf stars, like Planet X, folks, is as warm. It confirms the brown dwarf stars as warm bodies. They give off heat, actually quite a bit of heat. They don't capture enough amperage from space to light up their atmospheres in full glow mode like our sun, but they give off enough heat so that they will have a distinctive signature in the infrared part of the spectrum. With infrared capability, they are easy to spot. I'm not so sure that this article is an attempt to minimize the existence of wormwood, as it is a form of bragging rights about the optical power of the WISE satellite. By dividing the image capturing capability of the WISE into different bands, they can sort out the incoming infrared information picked up by the WISE satellite sensor array. And in this case, they could find a smaller sized T-series brown dwarf that gives off no visible light, nested in a busy sector of the sky with lots of bright stars around it. Remember, all stars give off infrared, but only the visible stars have glow mode plasma atmospheres that we can see visually with our eyes. The optical part, which is the optical part of the spectrum. Dividing the infrared bandwidth up gives a better sorting ability to the incoming data. The data comes in pre-sorted, easier to handle, and more useful. Then they compare the same sections of sky, identical picture targets, and their different infrared bandwidth slices, and they can discriminate the larger brown dwarf stars from the smaller brown dwarf stars, which are colder. It's a good technique. Actually, it's a really good technique. And the WISE satellite was assembled, lofted, and now operates on a fairly limited budget. It was and still is a bargain as a survey satellite. So if this star in Camelopardalis is the coolest brown dwarf image on the temperature scale, then Wormwood and the other brown dwarf stars will be warmer. It also suggests that Wormwood, me and John DiNardo don't know why Gilbert calls this thing Wormwood, because it's really not, but anyway, differing opinions there. It also suggests that Planet X will have a tendency to be larger, for example, to catch more energy from the electric plasma amperage of space. At least Wormwood is larger than this star in the Camel constellation. How much larger? We don't know. NASA doesn't want to talk about that part of the information. Want to guess why? As the stars get larger, they get hotter / warmer because they can catch more electric energy from space. When they get to the level of a red dwarf, they have a faint glow. There are a lot of red dwarf stars in our galaxy, like Proxima Centauri, the closest star to our sun that is not part of our solar system. It looks like there are also a lot of L-series brown dwarf stars, but not nearly as many T-series brown dwarf stars, the really small ones. That's what the WISE satellite was constructed to tell us, well, to tell NASA anyway. and the WISE uses good instrumentation to gather that survey data. Statistically, the odds are that Planet X is an L-series star, which is a larger type of brown dwarf. If Wormwood is not as cool in its temperature readings, then the odds get better that it's an L-series star. But if that's true, then it's bigger, and it will pack more gravitational punch and more electromagnetic punch. In other words, it will be more destructive instead of less destructive. Not good news. And last but not least, is there any doubt in your mind that if NASA can see a relatively small T-series brown dwarf star located 18 to 30 light years away, like outlined in this article from NASA, that it can also see a larger L-series brown dwarf that is within 2 light hours of our sun? If the WISE can spot something smaller that is light years away, then it can certainly spot something larger if it is only light hours away. So at this point, they are admitting that they do indeed have the power to see Planet X coming our way. There is no question that they can see it coming. With the WISE satellite surveying the whole sky, there is basically no way that it was going to miss Wormwood, larger and much closer. Interesting world, no? Well, at least the petty power politics is interesting. Thanks for the heads up, Gilbert Erickson. So I appreciate that email that Gilbert sent to me. Like I said, me and John DiNardo, we don't really prefer to call Planet X Wormwood anymore because that's not really what it is. It's not a planet. It's more like a cross between a planet and a star. And according to Gilbert, it's apparently, in best estimates, an L-class series brown dwarf star. Well, I appreciate everybody tuning into my show tonight. We're just about ready to close the show here in about a minute or less. I was actually planning on having John DiNardo on as my guest tonight, but he didn't answer his phone today, so much for that. Anyway, be sure to tune in to John Moore's show tomorrow afternoon from 2 to 4 p.m. Mountain Time. He actually manned up having John DiNardo on as a guest because he had said he was going to touch base with him a day or two ago. So, anyway, I appreciate everybody tuning into my show. And no idea what's going to be on next week, but just stay tuned to what's going on with Earth changes because, you know, according to what Marshall Masters said in that movie 2010, this may be the year we see two suns in the sky. So things could really be going to hell here before the end of the year. Who knows? I mean, the elites themselves may not even know exactly the exact day this thing is going to get here. All they can do is continue with their last-minute preparations and get their underground shelters in place and hope for the best. Well, like I said, I'll also be posting that John Morris, I'll be posting both of them sound bites on my website. I have a new subsection on my Archives Miscellaneous subpage you folks might want to check. You scroll down quite a ways, it's under John DiNardo, Gilbert Erickson, John Moore. It's a little section entitled the Planet X Radio Shows. I'll be posting new stuff in there. Anyway, thanks for tuning in to Light of Day. We'll be back next week. Good night, folks.